Morning.
Morning.
Looks like a beautiful day. I think Suzuki Roshi said when you're sitting cross-legged, sometimes it's like you're not sure which leg is on top. Especially if you're sitting Padmasana, like, wait, is it the left on top? Which was it? You have to kind of check it out. So sitting together, it's kind of it's a little bit like that. If we sit, you know, in stillness, naturally various thoughts will come up, but often at first, sitting there, you could be anybody, rather than I'm this particular person with all this particular stuff. You just be anybody. And that anybody-ness, everyone touches there. And then if you start to think about that, of course, stuff starts to churn. But those moments of perception are valid and important. And you might notice that they are most easily appreciated when when you just kind of turn yourself to practice. Either you sit down to cross your legs, or you're in your office or something, and you just have decided to recollect for a moment. Right away, there's some clarity. And then the clouds start to come up. But at first, there's some clarity. And one of Trungpa Rinpoche's favorite utterances was first thought, best thought. You like to telegraph that in Tibetan. And so sometimes even before first thought, there's something clear where you could be. Any person, and your own history, and our habituated sense of ourselves is revealed to be kind of vaporous. Even though we're used to being asked to have a very definite presence in the world, and not only that, but documented. So, like, if you don't have documents, it's a problem. So people who don't have documents are often, you know, they get into trouble of various kinds. And yet the documentation is of something vaporous. So this means that the light of liberation comes right through all of that stuff all the time, as our teachers have told us. And our practice is about developing our appreciation of that and ceasing to grab after something. Ben was just telling me that he and Nick have a friend who apparently has escaped the perils of homosexuality somehow and was received into the Mormon Church. And this has apparently solved all his problems, although probably not. And Ben said he thought that this person was really intimidated by uncertainty. And so, as a result, I tried to reach for something that seemed to be very certain. And I said, oh, that's just exactly the wrong thing to do. There is no remedy for the uncertainty of human situation. Instead, to open ourselves to uncertainty, to that vaporous quality of being is the direction of liberation rather than the direction of bondage. And I hope your friend finds that out before it's too late. In a way, it's never too late, but it's kind of a shame if people go through their life completely under that burden. And in order to do that, you have to ignore many, many inklings that maybe this isn't quite the right thing. You have to ignore many, many moments where the light is coming through the vapor. And it is kind of scary, you know? From the perspective of documentation, it's kind of scary. And our teachers have understood this perfectly well. And as you know, the Tibetans have a whole slew of horrible critters with teeth and flames and blood and all that stuff to represent that scariness, the frightening quality of liberation, the frightening quality of the light that comes through this vaporous invented being, this karmic manifestation. And it's so scary that we flee from it. We actually flee from that light. And of course, in their metaphorical representation, they talk about that happening at the moment of death, when the light is at its most intense, and the vapor is most completely dispelled. And because of the very intensity of that light, we flee from it and into darker and darker realms. And the propensities of karma then determine where we will land, as though we were a ball bouncing down a staircase. So it's kind of a challenge, you know, for us to find a way to steady ourselves in the face of this kind of intimidating quality of our actual being. The threat to the apparently established person. And sitting, of course, sitting practice helps us develop that steadiness so that the wind of change and instability, which is a part and parcel of our being, doesn't upset us so much. And that way, when we are confronted with the inevitability of change and uncertainty, we can meet it wholeheartedly as a pure reflection of our own being, not some threat to some creature who actually isn't there. We have a pamphlet, Ben or Nick discovered upstairs, The Benefits of Zen Meditation. And Nick said this morning, it's kind of, somebody said, it's kind of a short pamphlet. Maybe it was David. It actually is. It's a rather short pamphlet, but there's a lot of stuff in there. And this is Master Shen Yun, who died not so long ago. And he was a pretty great guy. And he says, a lot of people, they don't know anything about Dharma, so we try to hook them in with like pseudo-scientific talk about how Zen meditation will strengthen your endocrine balance or something, and cure, one guy says, tuberculosis, dysentery, what other things? Not migraine. We noticed there was no migraine there. But a bunch of other stuff. So it's like supposedly really good for you. And he says, but that really, what's really good for is this business about trying to clutch on to what will never hold still. This is what makes us sick, finally, and causes us to flee constantly into more and more profound illusions of stability. And the more forcefully we travel in that direction, the more intimidating liberation will appear. So it's kind of a problem for us sometimes. So as a kind of a way of dealing with this, you know, we sort of developed religiosity or religion. And I was reading in the National Geographic, for a long time there was the assumption that agriculture gave rise to religion. And now some other archaeologists are saying, you know, it doesn't necessarily look like that. We think maybe it's the other way around. Religion gave rise to agriculture. Because when people came together to study the mystery, say, suddenly there's a bunch of people around, and so there's all these people around, and they came to our, you know, circle of standing stones, and what are we going to do with them? There's nothing to eat. So this, of course, conjures the story of Jesus and the loaves and fishes. Which may be a reflection of this situation where people want to study the mystery, and how are you going to feed them? So they started, well, let's plant some corn next to the standing stones here so we can feed people when they come and study the mystery. So this may have been how it turned out. And this has resulted in a long history of various religious phenomena. There's quite a good story in the current New Yorker. I don't know if some of you subscribe to the New Yorker. The summer fiction issue has, as usual, a lot of the fiction is, you might say, rather gloomy, despairing even. For some reason, the New Yorker favors that kind of thing. I'm not sure why. But anyway, one story is by Jeffrey Eugenides, who's apparently rather well known. I don't know his stuff, but the story is quite good. And it's called Asleep in the Lord. And it's about a young fellow who was a religious studies major, which I also was for a while. I was a religious studies major. And graduates from college and decides to travel around. And he visits various centers of religiosity in Europe, mostly. Beautiful cathedrals and so forth, miracle places. And then he decides to go to India and hang out with Mother Teresa's people in Calcutta. And the story is kind of about how he confronts a rather different reality when he gets there. And in the hospital for the dying destitute, he encounters his own squeamishness with the messy qualities of human existence. And the story's kind of about how he's trying to bring together his noble intention with the fact that he's very uncomfortable with body products and illness. So the story does a very good job of showing how he kind of gets there a little bit, and then he sort of bounces off and winds up getting totally blasted on cannabis and riding in a rickshaw, which he swore he'd never do, back to the train station to go somewhere else, having bought himself like a crucifix to wear. And he also does, it's interesting, he does a very cruel thing. Another person who he met, who was staying at the guest house, was a, you know, kind of ordinary American guy who'd been to Thailand and had a lovely week or two with a Thai bar girl, and he had a picture of her. And so after they consume their cannabis drink, he sort of says, let me see that picture again, and he tears it in half and throws it away. And the other guy is like, what, fuck you, man, what are you doing that for? And he tells him, well, and he says some very insulting and hurtful things to him. And naturally, the guy is very pissed off. And then the young man hops on the train and goes wherever he's going next. So it was a very good picture of how engaging our religiosity, our impulse to study the mystery, and the gritty, inevitable qualities of our human life is pretty challenging. And of course, in this country, we don't see that so much, at least many of us don't. I realized, you know, when I read stories like this, or when I was studying Sanskrit and Indian culture, I've never encountered poverty and illness of the sort that is a daily challenge in those parts of the world. And I assume Eugenides knows something about the hospital, for instance, over there, Mother Teresa's hospital. And I was quite shocked at one of the things the man does finally manage to do is help bathe one of the dying men who has a grotesque tumor in his groin. And apparently there was no pain medicine. It's like, I don't get that. They have one of the doctors who was there, and apparently many of them don't stay very long. One of the doctors told him, oh, well, U.S. Or Western pharmaceutical companies usually send us stuff that's about to expire. And they send us stuff for like Western illnesses of prosperity, such as high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. We don't need that stuff. And the other stuff, we don't get. So he does manage to help bathe this gentleman, and that was about all he could manage. And then the next thing he encounters is a gentleman who is having a bowel movement in bed, and he basically turns and runs away. It's like, wow, this is, you know, this encounter with our, you know, the inevitable qualities of our physicality is a real challenge to our religiosity and to the fact that we can't really so easily maintain our documented stability in the face of what's actually happening all the time. So this young fellow doesn't seem to have a practice to fall back on, although he's attracted to the Jesus prayer of all things. Apparently in his family, he was actually baptized in the Orthodox Church. So he kind of likes the Jesus prayer. He has some trouble with like various parts of, or aspects of the prayer, and yet as he's riding towards the train station, he's saying it wholeheartedly this time. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. But he doesn't really have a practice of being still in the midst of the light of actuality, the blinding light of reality, which you don't see with your eyes, but you see with your heart. And so he runs away. And that temptation to run away is almost constantly there as a sort of quality of our karmic life, always trying to pull us away from the light. You know, go find some nice dark corner where you can hide out, except that you can't. There is no place to hide. And when we actually meet that truth with the integrity that is natural to us, benefits of Zen meditation actually are present. Namely, we are, in a sense, stronger. We are, in a sense, clearer. We are, in a sense, more available to other beings. Without ever having tried to contrive to bring those qualities forth, that's simply what happens. And it happens in large measure as we do stop that kind of grabbing onto something to slow us down, slow down this slide into the dissolving light. This is it's a severe practice, you know. And yet, I don't know of anything better. Whatever you call it, whatever its labels or history or provenance, it seems to me always the same. So we have this, we have these Zen stories, and there's Master Zuigan in Japanese, or Rueyan in Chinese. He's the one who would wake up in the morning and say, "Master," and he'd say, "Yes," and then he'd say, "All day long, don't let anyone fool you," and then he'd say, "Okay, I won't." And that was his practice. Every morning he'd wake up and do this. And this is extremely important. This "don't let anyone fool you" means also don't fool yourself. And people we are constantly trying to fool ourselves, and in Zen, other people try to fool us. For instance, trying to get us to practice by sort of kind of hinting, not usually saying right out, that we're not enlightened enough. You know? So we kind of try to suggest to people that in various ways, for instance, giving them silly questions and then not liking their answer. So we'd say, you know, "All right, student, what is mu?" You go, "Well, I don't know." "Oh, no, ring, 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 get out of here," you know. And then it's like, "Oh, I'm a terrible practitioner. I have to go sit harder," you know. This is fooling people. And so one day, if you're playing the game that way, you can come into the teacher, and the teacher says, "What is mu?" And you say, "I don't care." The teacher goes, "Oh, okay, you can go now." "I can't fool you anymore." You realize, oh, it was never, it's nothing to do with him or her. Nothing at all. And it never was. It's not even anything to do with, shockingly, Buddha. This is a very precious and powerful realization, and the minute it arises, let it go. And let natural life express itself. And then when your patient or friend or parent is having a bowel movement in bed, well, let's deal with it. Won't run away, just deal with it. And then you realize, well, yeah, this is kind of unpleasant, but so what? This way of living or practice reveals the bottomless integrity of our own life, our own experience, and how that integrity is reflected in everything around us and all the people we meet. And this is the greatest gift, I think. So try really hard not to let anyone fool you. Especially me. And I might try, but don't let me get away with it. It's not about me. Wait, is that the advertising slogan nowadays? Oh, no, no, no. It's all about you. Right, that's right. So this is the opposite. It's not about me. It's about us, in a sense. In the sense that, as I was saying, you just kind of sit there. We're kind of nobody and everybody. In those moments of quiet, that's the truth. And then, next thing you know, next minute, maybe you're dealing with your credentials. Well, it's all right. Just don't be fooled. That's all. There is that old saying, "That which doesn't kill me makes me stronger." We have living proof here. Chuck and Larry just been through the entire Wagner Ring cycle. There they are, glowing. Are there any questions or comments? sing a few bars?
Yeah, like I wish I could.
Yeah.
And that little delicate yelp.
Oh, yeah, that must take some training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, actually, we still have Brother Damron.
Oh, is that tonight?
No, it's tomorrow.
Oh, it's tomorrow. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's this free hero who's, you know, able to accomplish things that the gods can't do because they're not bound by all their conventions and traditions and so forth and so on. And I can't decide whether he's an obnoxious jerk or whether he's really an ideal.
Is he kind of a real mensch?
I think he is.
Oh.
You know? But what I find different, I mean, I don't mind so much, you know, I guess maybe I never had such a strong sense of self-identity to begin with, but you know, letting that drop is not a problem until I have to deal with other people, which I do all the time.
Of course.
And what I find is that they really, really want me to be something. I mean, the sense
yes.
I get from people is they really want me to be something.
That's right. They are trying to fool you.
They are trying to fool you. But
they
I feel like if I just sort of walked out on them or just said what I wanted to say, that wouldn't be that helpful either.
Yes, well, I trust your judgment. Sometimes it's not, actually, to say, you know, you're having a complex conversation with someone and you tell them, you know what, you're just trying to fool me, so fuck off. I mean, that's kind of like, that might be skillful at some time, but it also often isn't because people aren't ready for that. They do not want to have their attention returned to the light, even though they do. They actually do. That's what everyone desperately wants, but you kind of have to, you can invite, but you cannot compel. And Hakuin Zenji, you know, I've been accused of being kind of sectarian. I guess I am. Hakuin Zenji was a, you know, Rinzai guy, and he was kind of cool, but he did admit that he'd made a terrible mistake, at least one, in his work with others. He said, this guy who was, you know, kind of a little eccentric, but who had been practicing, came and said, told Hakuin that he'd you know, had realization, and Hakuin kind of tore him a new one, so to speak, in response, and the guy went insane and killed himself. So Hakuin said, that was a mistake. And the mistake was, you cannot compel people to look where they are not prepared to look. That is a very wrong thing to do. And our friend in the story was kind of doing that. Here, give me your bar girl picture, I'll tear it up and throw it in the gutter for you. Well, that was not the thing to do. All it did was injure and anger that man. It was not helpful at all. So we have to be careful. To some degree, take our cue from others and be, as is so challenging, allow ourselves to be touched by their suffering, which is the meaning of compassion. And that way we will be much less likely to brutalize them in return when they're not really ready for that or asking us for that or giving us permission for that. And some people, you know, they say, well, you know, the teacher-student relationship is fraught with danger. That's the main danger. Is that the teacher in particular will take some liberty with the student that is actually injurious, frightening, and repellent to them. Now, the other side is, of course, the teacher is also vulnerable. You don't hear about that so much. But mostly it's the student who may not be ready for a particular confrontation, or asking for it, or giving permission for it, and yet teacher, because the Zen master, does it anyway. And the result is an injury. And that is not helpful. That could, traditionally speaking, drive that person back into the dark realms for kalpas. So this is why sometimes Zen is faulted for being an excessively wisdom-oriented tradition and lacking in compassion. And this is true. This is one of our pitfalls. It's also possible to go the other way. A tradition that is heavy, heavy, heavy on compassion without wisdom. But that's probably in some ways less dangerous. I don't know. I'm just speculating. awfully glad to have people like you to sit with and surrender credentials with. It's really nice. Yes.
Yeah, I think you're speaking to this, you know, now and sitting with that is that it was a struggle for me to get here this morning, and I'm so glad that I did. And maybe to speak to how Sangha and community can really help to bring awareness of not letting yourself be fooled.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way you began Dharma talk of like saying you're just sitting with others. There's this moment of just openness and clarity of mind that you're myself, but I'm with any self,
mm-hmm.
or all these selves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering if you could speak more. I like what you were saying here about the when you are with others, to just one side be careful not to injure, no one harm another, and the other part is how to maybe be mindful not to to fool them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly, in this story that I keep going back to, at this guest house where the fellow was staying, there was kind of a whole table of people who were all volunteering at Mother Teresa's place. And he described sitting with them, and it sounded very, very pleasant. Like, people were kind of gentle and quiet and asking each other where they were from and how things were going and so forth. It sounded very nice, and he didn't want to sit with them. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't know, Eugenides is one of these authors who doesn't necessarily spell everything out, which is nice, because sometimes that can be awfully heavy-handed. He doesn't exactly say what he didn't like about them, but you kind of got the feeling like, well, they're kind of, I don't know, sort of seem namby-pamby or something. Maybe they're just being, you know, superficially polite or something. But actually, it sounded like, well, that sounds kind of like Sangha. People who are actually recognizing that they were engaged in something a little bit challenging, and that this invites a certain kind of respect and care for one another because of this endeavor, and that manifests in a kind of gentle, attentive, and respectful behavior. So I think that is one, at its best anyway, that's what characterizes Sangha. People recognizing that something a little difficult about this, a little scary, why don't we be open to each other and look after each other carefully, and you know, not take liberties with one another, and when we make a mistake, let's say we're sorry. These are qualities of Sangha at its best. At its worst, it's a snake pit, and if you've lived in community, you know what I mean. And okay, so if it's a snake pit, is that like, is there no remedy? Well, yeah, there is. If we say, you know what, this is a snake pit, let's take care of it. And when they can't say that, that is very, very sick. And I sometimes fear that, we're a little small for that kind of thing to happen. But as the Sangha gets bigger and bigger, it gets easier and easier for these particularly institutional phenomena to start manifesting themselves. And if we're blind to those, we're in serious trouble. And then the snake pit is allowed to fester, while on the surface, everything's fine. We are the great and holy people of God. No problems here at all. And actually, things are not going well. And I confess, I see this not so far away sometimes. And anybody can make a mistake, including me. The problem is when you can't say, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. That's when Sangha turns into something not very good. So this mutual recognition that actually we're all kind of the same on some level, and if there's any fooling going on, it had better be rooted in compassion and clear-eyed dedication to the Buddha way or the truth or whatever you call it, and that people are up for it. And if they say, I'm not up for that, respect that. Say, okay, well, sorry. My teacher said he once took his stick and whacked somebody. And she wasn't up for that. She took it and threw it out the window. Okay, I guess that wasn't the time for that. Or maybe it was, you know. But anyway, she had a different reaction than he anticipated. So he thought, well, that was instructive. And if at that point, you know, then there's like, you know, anger and rejection and so forth, that then can't be dealt with, then that's a problem. Then the going further with that and saying, oh, maybe that wasn't so good, I'm sorry, that was a wrong thing to do, it was maybe disrespectful of your place, your person, I apologize. These are qualities that manifest in Sangha and that Sangha supports and that are fed by, so to speak, sitting with one another just as anybody, and letting that light manifest the light that you can't see with your eyes. Speaking of light, next week is Pride Weekend, I think Hartford Street is going to have a certain presence at the parade, and you're all invited. We're gonna hang with the Page Street gang, the Rainbow Kids from Page Street, and some of us have bought T-shirts, which Nick and Ben collaborated on a really, really nice design of a T-shirt for Hartford Street. I think if you order today, you can still get one in time, but it would have to be today. Although when I ordered it yesterday, they said, oh, you'll have it like Tuesday, but they don't promise that. But if you order it today, you'll have it by next Saturday. You have to add $5 for rush, though. So, but it's a beautiful T-shirt, and these guys can tell you how to get one, and Cheryl can too, I'm not quite sure. You click some button, you're all invited. Please come to that. And then the following week is the 4th of July, and we're going to have a little closure for the sake of our poor, exhausted residents. So we'll probably be closed the Saturday and the Monday. So it's a great time for y'all to go out of town and do something fun, camping or something like that. And then the week after, I think we have a guest speaker, although it escapes me who right now. I think finally some guest speakers have cropped up. So I think we'll get these guys to put that, or maybe you, somebody, put that on our new website, which also Ben and Nick and Cheryl have been laboring on, and it looks really nice. So we'll have a space for like announcing upcoming speakers and stuff. So many fun things happening here. Any other questions or comments?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to add to that, if there's anyone in the room who's involved in any of the meditation groups.
Who meet here and use our space?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have pages for each of those groups on the website, and right now the information is sort of incomplete, and if there's anyone here who's part of that group and wants to add to that, just let me know.
For instance, Friday Meditation and Recovery, or Wild Geese, or any of those. My God, you're the only female here. I'm sorry. Sometimes that happens. Anyway, there's these various groups, and we'd love to have a fuller description and presence for them on our own website. So you help us out with that. Yeah, Richard?
Oh, and I understand Cheryl informed me that we're going to be having a potluck here next Saturday.
Pride potluck.
I'd forgotten about that. Saturday. So bring something yummy and vegetarian, and bring your friends. We'll celebrate.
We'll bring toast.
And you'll bring toast. Toast is a food, but also a dog. Thank you very much.